From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair and U.S. President George W. Bush may part ways on global warming, but they have stood shoulder to shoulder in the war on terror, in the aftermath of 9/11, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. Now, after nearly 4 years and hundreds of billions of dollars spent, terror has struck the heart of London. No one promised an easy fight, but are we fighting the right way? Tonight on Point, the fundamental Bush-Blair strategy in the war on terror, how it's working and whether it's working. We'll hear from top experts in the field and you. But first, we begin tonight in London with a closer look at today's deadly attacks. For a high-level perspective, we turn to Charles Heyman, senior defense analyst for Jane's Consultancy Group. I asked him for his thoughts on what unfolded today in London's morning rush hour.
From a terrorist point of view, it's been a very successful attack and a terrible blow to London. But we knew it was coming. All of our politicians and all of our policemen have been saying for 3 years now that it is inevitable. That the terrorists will get through our security cordon in the end. We know, for instance, that the Metropolitan Police has probably foiled at least 20 attacks over the last 3 years. This one got through. We'll have to remain vigilant. We'll have to be prepared for other attacks as the years go by.
A bloody day in London, a tragic one, but far fewer deaths than in Madrid in March of last year. 191 died there. What's your reading of how this was precisely planned and carried out? Why not in more crowded locations? Why not an even higher death rate?
It's really very, very difficult to say. At this stage, it may well be the explosive used, it may be the devices used, it may be that the groups that did the London bombings weren't quite as technically skilled as the group in Madrid. It may well be that we just got a little bit luckier, although we've had a terrible day, that we were just a little bit luckier than Madrid. You never know in these circumstances, and sometimes it takes weeks and even months to work out really what happened.
Well, your thoughts on, more precisely, on who may have been behind this? Okay, Al-Qaeda linked, but London-based, not European-based, people who've come in or planned on the inside, any indications?
No real indications at the moment. We have a fundamentalist group coming up on a website saying that they had carried out this attack.
The so-called secret Al-Qaeda jihad organization in Europe.
That's right, yeah, and saying basically that Britain should get its troops out of Afghanistan and Iraq. So we have to keep looking at this very, very carefully. There is a chance that these people are involved. Looks like the only credible claim so far, and it would almost certainly involve probably some homegrown operators here at the reconnaissance and the logistic side of the operation, maybe even in the execution of the operation itself. We've already seen a couple of British Muslims acting as suicide bombers in Iraq, and it is possible that the same thing happened here. But we're really speculating at this stage. Nobody's got any really hard evidence to go on. A lot of people are saying, though, that they think that it was a suicide bomber on the bus near Russell Square. It's going to take a few more days, really, to get to sort out the wheat from the chaff here and really understand what happened.
How will British authorities begin to do that after an attack or series of attacks like this? How do they go about trying to figure out who did it?
Well, of course, we've been doing this for years. I mean, we've had 30 years of an IRA bombing campaign. What will be happening at the moment is that there will be forensic teams at all of the bomb locations. They'll be picking up every bit of forensic evidence that they possibly can. Remember, it is quite possible that you can get a fingerprint, for instance, off a remnant or a piece of a bomb. Certainly the forensic search is going to be very important. They'll be looking already at all of the CCTV cameras. Now, London is probably the most CCTV-cameraed city in the world.
It's closed-circuit cameras everywhere.
Closed-circuit television cameras everywhere. And they will be able to look at people going into the underground, and they'll be able to look at people getting onto buses, things like that. They'll also certainly be looking very, very carefully at intercepts, mobile phone intercepts, email intercepts, things like that. And the human intelligence side of things will be very, very important. That the security services will now be talking to all of their contacts inside the Muslim community.
Would you expect London security routines to change going forward?
from a government point of view and from a security services point of view, I don't think there's an awful lot more they can really, really do.
We hear in Madrid they've implemented airport-style metal detectors at the entrances to public transportation.
Yeah, that, they may well have to do that at some stage. But it's going to slow London down enormously. You know, that sort of thing is possible. But I think that one of the things you're really looking for here is a vigilant public. When the public are really, really aware of what's going on around them, then suspicious, unusual behavior is reported straight away. And that really, really upsets potential terrorists, potential wrongdoers, when they know that the public are looking out for them and watching their every move. And that certainly is going to happen, and it'll be going on from now on.
Do you expect a change in British attitudes toward anti-terror strategy, toward the Iraq War, toward Afghanistan because of this?
I think there will be a hardening of attitudes. I think that's inevitable, absolutely inevitable. Up to now, to a certain extent, quite large numbers, I think, of the British public have been rather sceptical about some of the announcements from the government and the security services. That won't happen anymore. There will be a hardening of attitude. And also, I believe, if I know the British people, a hardening of resolve. I don't think for one second we're going to withdraw our troops from Afghanistan or from Iraq. We might actually find a few more to send.
Charles Heyman, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Charles Heyman is Senior Defense Analyst for Jane's Consultancy Group. He spoke with me from London. World leaders at the G8 summit released a joint statement after this morning's attacks, condemning the killing and pledging unity against terror. Richard Wolff is White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine and has been covering the G8 summit in Gleneagles, Scotland. I asked him how the mood has changed at the summit as London reels.
Well, very dramatically. People were on the verge of really a whole series of deals. They still are, but the news was breaking as the first session began in Gleneagles, and the mood very quickly changed to one of obviously support for Tony Blair and the British people, but also one of resolve and determination to at least look like this is business as usual. But I have to say, as Prime Minister Paul Martin of Canada said, there was a pall cast over the whole proceedings. The impression is there of business as usual, but the mood really isn't.
Richard, what about Tony Blair's body language and language this morning? He made quite an emotional statement to the press before he flew back to London.
Yeah, very emotional. He has a strong determination to fight this war on terror just as strongly as President Bush. And you saw some flashes of that today. There was emotion. There was also anger. I think it's fair to say it was shock and anger, not just for Tony Blair, but among all the British officials here.
President Bush himself said in his brief comments today, the war on terror goes on.
Yeah.
Is there consensus among the leaders gathered there today about exactly what that means or should mean?
Today, there probably is consensus because it's very clear what kind of terrorism we're talking about. But the president has obviously, since he started to turn his attention towards Iraq, expanded that definition of terror and war to a country that many of the other world leaders here today, and it wasn't just the G8, there were countries like China and India there too, don't feel comfortable with. Today's example of terrorism is very clear, but in the president's mind, when he says the war on terror goes on, just think back to his speech about Iraq just last week, where he linked very closely Iraq to the fight against al-Qaeda and the events of 9/11. In his mind, the war on terror includes Iraq. And I think for many of these world leaders, that case is still not that clear. And of course, you know, American officials now can make a fairly credible case that many of the people they're fighting against are foreign fighters who have traveled to Iraq to fight coalition forces there. So there are some similarities there, and security officials, intelligence officials have voiced concerns to us and other media that there are people who are going to be coming out of Iraq, if they haven't already, in much the same way that they left Afghanistan, to return to their home countries in the West, in countries that may be part of the coalition, to carry out terrorist attacks there. There is an overlap there that there almost certainly wasn't before the invasion of Iraq began. But I think you're not going to hear that kind of comment now because people are trying to figure out what happened, how many people have died, and those basic pieces of information are still not in place today.
Just briefly, Richard, what happens to the agenda of the G8 summit on Africa, on global warming, climate change?
Still going on, still negotiating it. We expect communiques to start coming out tomorrow, which is the last day. There's been a lot of intensive work behind the scenes. As I think we were saying yesterday, this has been something of a nail-biter. There's been a lot of discussion about the text, about certain language, not least on things like climate change. I imagine that whatever battles people were fighting have sort of paled into insignificance after today. Certainly, even from countries like France, where there have been these sort of rivalries and tensions, the mood from them today was much more positive about everything, including how far President Bush has moved on things like climate change.
Images of blood and mayhem coming out of London today on TV screens there as well. There you are in Scotland with these G8 leaders in a luxury hotel and golfing resort. An air of unreality to today there,
yeah.
Richard?
And distance as well. A certain amount of frustration. I mean, there's frustration in London about how the information was coming out. But you can see that sense of unreality that obviously Blair was feeling too, and he left very rapidly on a Chinook helicopter to go down to London. There was a sense of both determination to get things through, to carry on with business, but also a sense of, well, what do we do now? Who chairs the meeting and what's going to happen? In the end, the Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, came up, so they worked things out. But people's attention was very much focused on London, even as they were thinking and talking about climate change in Africa.
The whole world, G8 included, today. Richard, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Richard Wolff is White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with me from Gleneagles, Scotland. We are talking tonight about the fundamental Bush-Blair strategy on terror and how it's working, whether it's working. You can join the conversation tonight. What's the meaning of the London attacks? What do they tell us about our enemies, our defenses, our strategy? Going on 4 years after 9/11, do we have the right approach on fighting terrorism? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about today's terrorist attacks in London and whether the Bush-Blair approach to fighting terrorism is working. Prime Minister Tony Blair addressed his nation today and called for unity against terrorism.
When they seek to change our country or our way of life by these methods, we will not be changed. When they try to divide our people or weaken our resolve, we will not be divided, and our resolve will hold firm. We will show, by our spirit and dignity, and by a quiet but true strength, that there is in the British people, that our values will long outlast theirs.
President Bush also spoke, vowing no let-up in his anti-terror campaign.
The war on terror goes on. I was most impressed by the resolve of all the leaders in the room. Their resolve is as strong as my resolve, and that is we will not yield to these people. We'll not yield to the terrorists. We will find them, we'll bring them to justice, and at the same time we will spread an ideology of hope and compassion that will overwhelm their ideology of hate.
You can join our conversation tonight. Has the war in Iraq made London safer? Has it made the U.S. safer? Is the fundamental American strategy on the right track? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is Jessica Stern, lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of Terror in the Name of God, Why Religious Militants Kill. She's former super terrorism fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and former national fellow at the Hoover Institution. Jessica Stern, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also joining us from Washington is Michael Scheuer. He was a senior intelligence analyst at the CIA and was the originally anonymous author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. He directed the Bin Laden unit at the CIA until 1999. Michael Scheuer, thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, sir. Thank you kindly.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Michael Scheuer, first to you. What's the lesson you're taking out? It's a very short time, not even a full day since the bombs went off in London, but what's the lesson you're taking away about the fundamental Bush-Blair strategy, if we can call it that, and whether it's working, how it's working?
Well, it's not really a Bush-Blair strategy so much as a bipartisan American strategy, which Blair has signed on to, I think. And it's, we saw today, again, basically a Pavlovian response to the attacks in London, that these people want to change our way of life and destroy our liberties and destroy our freedoms.
Don't they?
No. They may not like what we how we live, and their countries wouldn't resemble ours, but the motivation has to do with American foreign policy and the way it's perceived in the Islamic world. And that's not to argue that the perception is correct, but the perception is the perception. Muslims generally believe, if the Western polling firms are accurate, that American foreign policy is an attack on Islam. And bin Laden's strength comes from that belief amongst many, many Muslims, not just the lunatic fringe.
So what does that say about American strategy? What's right with it? What's wrong with it?
Well, I don't think you can really reasonably expect to defeat the enemy if you don't care about understanding what his motivation is. And I think we continue to be exactly in that position. We don't think that our support for Israel has anything to do with it. We don't think the fact that we and the Israelis are occupying the three most holy places in Islam has anything to do with this. We don't think that American support for Arab tyrannies across the Middle East has anything to do with this. And as long as we don't realize that, Al-Qaeda and its supporters are in the driver's seat, because we will never be able to defeat a group that is growing at the pace that this one is.
Jessica Stern, join us here. President Bush says, we've taken the war to the terrorists in Iraq, so we don't have to fight it here. Dick Cheney has said, you know, you've got to hit them hard. That's what will make them know we're serious. That's what will let them know we can't be beaten. A lot of standing up and saluting that general view today in London, in Scotland, at the G8 meeting. What about the fundamental strategy? We hear Michael Scheuer's misgivings about it. What do you think?
Well, I'm afraid I agree. I certainly think the war in Iraq is pouring fuel onto a fire that existed prior to that war, but has gotten significantly worse, and it's enabling actually the Al-Qaeda movement to recruit in Europe. Europe has become a very important center for the Islamist movement as a place to raise money for the war in Iraq and as a place to recruit operatives. And a kind of pipeline is going back, partly as a result of the work of Mr. Zarqawi, back and forth from Europe. And so this is what we have created.
So you're saying that the Iraq war is militarizing or ideologically radicalizing the Muslim population in Europe?
Absolutely.
But wasn't it already, even before Iraq, there were mosques with vitriolic speakers calling for the new caliphate and all that? That preceded the war in Iraq.
Yes, and that's why I'm saying that it's pouring fuel on an already existing fire, but it's quite dramatic, the results that we see. And bin Laden himself has said that to us, how essentially grateful he is that we did this for him.
So all this effort and... Okay, let's look at it this way. People have said, yes, it was a bad attack today in London, but it could have been a lot worse. Can the administration take credit for putting pressure on Al-Qaeda so that they don't have more resources to put into this kind of attack on London?
I think it's a very complicated picture. Absolutely, there have been quite a few attacks that have been thwarted. We heard there are quite a few attacks that have been thwarted within the UK alone. Also, globally, major strikes, we're told, by U.S. government authorities. Some of our efforts are paying off. At the same time, when we see what's going on with this, the rise of European jihadis, and it's really the war in Iraq has really playing a significant role. And I agree also with Mike Scheuer about our policy in Israel, which is very much discussed among Muslims in Europe, not just Islamist ones, but ordinary Muslims who are deeply distressed about both occupations.
Jack Beatty, what do you see here? Are we fighting the right war, the wrong war, the fundamental strategy, working, not working? What does London tell us?
Well, it seems to me it tells us that Iraq, leave aside these counterproductive qualities of the Iraq intervention we've just been spoken of, just imagine that it was a neutral business, that it's not producing more terrorists or making more enemies for us. Just consider the opportunity costs here. $200 billion have been spent in this venture. Secretary Rumsfeld was saying it may go to 2012. We had an economist on our program before the war began who predicted, and had charts and so on, that if it ran that long, we'd be talking somewhere around the neighborhood of $1 trillion. Now, the question is, what kind of security could we buy for $1 trillion versus the security that we're buying in Iraq?
What kind of security are you thinking of there, Jack? What might that money be spent on?
Well, you know, earlier in the week, maybe it was last week, President Bush denigrated police work. He said, oh, you know, some people think the war on terror is just police work. But you know what? The whole Marine Corps couldn't have prevented today's attack. Police work could have. Spies could have. Bribes could have. Turning people could have. Infiltration could have. So his just the very thing he was running down is the kind of thing we could spend money on to protect ourselves as opposed to what we're spending it on abroad.
$1 trillion by 2012, that is a lot of money, a lot of ways to spend it. Let's turn to our callers. Charles is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Charles, what do you think?
Well, I think I got to go all the way back to September 11th where our reaction, it just baffled me because there was no way that we knew for sure, you know, where they came from, you know, what had happened definitively. And, you know, when it finally all pans out, there's 17 of the 22 participants that day were from Saudi Arabia, as far as I remember.
So?
Correct me if I'm wrong or not. Then you see President Bush walking hand in hand with a Saudi prince less than a month ago looking like I hate to say this, but a poster boy for you know, gay marriage, which is, you know, neither here nor there.
Hey, a different culture. Come on, let's not.
Okay. I'm sorry. But I guess, you know, when I think of what's happening, you know, with us, there's, you know, so many other ways we could have gone. And to go and try to attack and try to beat them down is just a total wrong thing, because what we've got to do is try to understand where they're coming from, as that man said earlier.
But what do you do with that understanding? I mean, when you take a blow, Dick Cheney says you've got to go out and show them that they cannot get away with that. What do you suggest as an alternative, Charles?
Well, in Britain today, if I could be in charge of the security forces and things, I would shut down the border, I would shut down the coastline, I would shut down all the airports. There would be nobody going in or out of Britain until we were able to get a handle on who did it, where these guys are.
So you're saying kind of Fortress Britain or Fortress America, rather than reaching out to hit people in Afghanistan and Iraq, isn't it important to go to the source?
No, I'm not trying to Fortress America. I'm trying to talk about just this one thing. When this happens, for us to communicate to the terrorists how we view this, you know, we say we're going to seek justice and, you know, get the guilty parties, and then, so we wage a war and we kill thousands of people, but never find the actual guilty parties. And so, to me, if you just shut your country down when they've attacked you in your country and find them before they can get out, because how do they get out? I mean, somebody's going to point them out after a while.
Maybe not. Charles, thanks for your call. Michael Scheuer, take us into a little more nuance here. You're saying at the beginning you don't like the fundamental strategy, but yet there's a lot of police work that has gone on in addition to the warfare that's gone on. So. Are there pieces that are working and pieces that are not?
Well, there's
pick
really
apart.
There's no other pieces. I think that's the problem. There, the two major pieces in our combat and our war effort are military and intelligence, with a subsidiary role for law enforcement. And, you know, America has never fought a war only with those offensive tools, those murdering tools, which are very necessary and will have to be used more aggressively. But at the moment, we have no diplomacy, we have no propaganda, we have no public diplomacy.
No propaganda, but we've got this big television station set up in the Middle East. We've heard a lot about them.
The problem we have, the 9/11 Commission, the President, Mr. Clinton, they all have a belief that somehow Muslims don't understand what we're doing, and if they understood it, they would like us. The reality is Muslims think they know exactly what we're up to. We're up to supporting tyrannies and to rule them.
But President Bush says we're up to propagating democracy. We took out a tyrant in Saddam Hussein.
And we support the Saudis who are at least the worst at least as bad a tyrant, and Mubarak and the Algerian general.
But there's talk of elections in all three of those. Well, at least in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, there's talk of more democracy.
Well, there's lots of talk, and there's been talk as long as I've ever been an intelligence officer, sir. But, you know, when we get back to law enforcement, I think there's a big role for law enforcement, but I don't think it's possible to be done because I don't think we're led by serious people. If we were led by serious people, we would have an immigration policy and a border policy that at least let us know who's in our country. The law enforcement forces in the United States are absolutely overwhelmed because the Congress is too cowardly to step forward and help them, at least temporarily, to find out who is in this country and control the borders.
So, Michael Sawyer, stand by. I want to get another perspective in here, if I may. Joining us from Washington now is Hella Dale, Director of Foreign Policy and Defense Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Hella Dale, thank you for being with us tonight.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
We're looking at U.S. sort of fundamental strategy in light of what we've seen in London today and what this attack tells us about whether it's working or not. What do you say?
Clearly, the attack in London came under the radar screen. I think we've been pretty effective in this country, actually. We haven't seen any attacks since 9/11, but the rest of the world has. And the British police is very good. European police is very good. However, some of the measures they've taken have not been as strong as we have over here. And I think we all knew that we were going to see more terrorist attacks in. Yes, it's a surprise, but it's not a huge surprise. It's a tragedy.
But we're hearing tonight, Jessica Stern is with us. She says the war in Iraq is pouring fuel on the fire, especially among European Muslims who have easy access to the UK and not such difficult access to the USA, we've learned. Michael Scheuer says we're not paying attention to the fundamentals here, that the basic strategy is off base. Do you think that the take it to them approach that President Bush has outlined, fight them there so we don't have to fight them here, approach is working?
I think it's the only real approach you can take. I don't think that we want to sit here waiting for them to come and attack us again. I absolutely would disagree that it would be the wrong way to look at this war. You have to try and fight it on their turf. But clearly, if you do that, you are going to stir up a hornet's nest, and that's what we're seeing. We're seeing it in Iraq, and now we saw it in London. This is a war that is far from over, and I think we have to face that. We're going to be in it for quite a long time. Fortunately, I would say, the British are not the kind of people who are going to turn away, go away, and surrender, saying, we don't want to be in this anymore. They're very tough people. They've been through wars in their time. They have seen attacks on Britain before, so I think they're not going to bow out of this, as indeed the Prime Minister Blair indicated.
Pretty famously, though, we've seen a lot of popular opposition to that Iraq war. Jessica Stern, Hella Dale says, what's the alternative? Are you just going to sit here in the United States and wait for the terrorism to come to you? You've got to go out and address it where it originates. What do you say to that?
Well, the terrorism that we were going out to address did not originate in Iraq, as we all know. Iraq was not a center of terrorism until we went to war there, and now it certainly is. And as the CIA is now conceding, it has become an extremely important training grounds for the operatives that eventually will make their way into Saudi Arabia, back into Europe, some already are, and into our cities, into the United States. But much, much better trained. They are now getting to fight in war games against the best trained military on earth, working together with former Iraqi intelligence and military personnel, criminals. They are getting the most extraordinary training. This is going to be a quite formidable international jihadi force. And the war in Iraq has really facilitated the creation, the training of that force.
Hella Dale, what do you say to that? That we're breeding our own enemies for years to come. Yes, it's going to be a long war, but it needn't be as bad as it's going to be because of what's happened in Iraq.
I think Iraq in the long term is going to be essential in this war. I would disagree that there was no nexus between Iraq and terrorism before this war.
Yeah, but between 9/11, there's been very little proven there. President Bush and Vice President Cheney themselves have said so at this point.
Well, I mean, I think there is certainly more terrorism afoot than hit us at 9/11. Hamas, Hezbollah, these organizations are very wide networks. Hezbollah in particular is one that is of concern to a lot of people, and which, you know, there were clear ties to Saddam Hussein.
But much more to Iran than to Iraq.
Indeed, yes. I mean, this is, as I said, this is a much bigger picture, one that's far from over. And yes, certainly Iraq continues to be a problem. However, in the long run, I have no doubt that if we do succeed in Iraq, and I don't think we have a choice but to stick it out, we will have created something really important in the Middle East that can be a turning point.
So you say steady as she goes. Michael Scheuer, we hear you saying no, a fundamental course correction, please. I want to thank you both for being with us tonight. Hella Dale at the Heritage Foundation and Michael Scheuer, author of Imperial Hubris, longtime intelligence analyst at the CIA. Michael Scheuer, thank you for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, sir. Thank you.
We're talking about the fundamental Bush-Blair strategy on Iraq and how it's working, whether it's working. You can join us when George Bush says the war on terror goes on. Does he have the right war in mind? This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the fundamental Bush-Blair strategy, if you can call it that, on terror. I don't mean it's not a strategy, but is it a Bush-Blair strategy, an American strategy with Blair riding along, call it what you will. We'll look at how it's working and whether it's working tonight. You can join us. What do the attacks in London say about President Bush's fight them over there view? Are we fighting the right war in President Bush's war on terror? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight by Jessica Stern, author of Terror in the Name of God, lecturer in public policy at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. We're joined right now from Washington, D.C. by Daniel Byman. He's director of security studies at Georgetown University, former staff member of the 9/11 Commission. He's been with us many times over these last years since 9/11. Daniel Byman, thank you for joining us this evening.
My pleasure.
So here we are. We've heard a fundamental disagreement here tonight, but I must say the preponderance of those we've heard from saying they've got real questions about the fundamental strategy the U.S. is pursuing. How are you assessing it with the attacks in London in mind today?
The attacks in London show a fundamental problem with overall U.S. strategy. We've focused a lot of attention on the al-Qaeda core, the people around bin Laden and bin Laden himself, and in many ways been reasonably successful, or at least more successful than many people expected.
No bin Laden in hand, but others.
Right, but others, and really the core of the organization, what we know of it, quite severely affected. But on the other hand, this broader ideology and this broader movement has spawned hundreds of imitators and small cells that aren't quite as skilled, aren't quite as motivated, but nevertheless can be exceptionally lethal. And what we saw in Madrid, what we saw in London, this is the problem today, which are groups that might not be the equivalent of the Hamburg cell that carried out 9/11, but nevertheless are extremely bloody and are hard to detect and hard to catch.
You know, 9/11 was just earth-shattering in the numbers, in the imagery, in the symbolism of this attack in the heart of Manhattan. Today, it's bad. It's terrible. Hundreds wounded, dozens dead, but it is much less severe. Does that mean that the general al-Qaeda movement, the movement of Islamist fundamentalist terrorists, has been weakened?
There are a couple things to remember. First of all, with the September 11th attacks themselves, bin Laden really only expected that about 1,000 people would die, as horrible as that astounding figure is. He didn't expect the towers to fall. Mm-hmm. We didn't expect the towers to fall. And had the London attack been a little different, and we still don't know the full casualty figure, but easily could have been much more. The Madrid attacks easily could have been much more. These are the same overall ballpark. I mean, needless to say, there's a huge difference between 37 dead or whatever the final figure is and 3,000. But these are groups that really want to kill and really want to kill in large numbers. In the past, we saw terrorist groups that wanted a few dead bodies and a lot of media attention to send a message, but there's a real sense here of vengeance in the name of God, that killing a fair number of people is what they should be doing.
We see that, but a smaller number today than 9/11, a smaller number than Madrid, and yet Jessica Stern with us tonight says you've got a growing wave, kind of even tidal wave, gas on the fire coming out of the war in Iraq. If you could wave your magic wand, if you were the policy boss, Daniel Byman, would you
stick with some parts of this fundamental strategy in President Bush's war on terror? Would you throw it out wholesale? How would you tweak or change the basic bearings of this effort to counteract? I mean, what we want to get to is an end to this kind of terror. How would you do it?
An end to this kind of terror is not going to happen. The realistic goal is a reduction. And what we saw in London is a good example. I mean, what the heart of counterterrorism is today, for the most part, is working with allied governments around the world to disrupt cells, to go after individuals who might be involved in terrorism. And the Brits are about as good and about as aggressive as any Western government. And if they can suffer an attack, so too can others. And it's unrealistic, sadly, to expect that the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who are angry at the United States and the Muslim world and committed to some degree of violence, and supportive of it, I should say, are going to be gentled with a few easy steps. So this is a long-term effort, and we're going to see more attacks in the years to come. The real key will be doing what I hope Britain does in the days to come, which is managing the psychological effects, recognizing that the deaths, however tragic, however horrible, that the economy needs to go on, that the broader public life needs to go on, because that disruption is something that the terrorists try to create and can greatly magnify the immediate human cost of an attack.
You know, we see that, and we hear a fair amount of the stiff upper lip is pretty evident from London today, but I hear you kind of fundamentally accepting the envelope of the underlying strategy here. You're saying this is what it is, this is how we're going to pursue it, and this is the best way we've got?
To a degree, yes. I mean, there are some things that the war in Iraq is a great example of something that, in my mind, had nothing to do with the struggle against al-Qaeda, yet the United States went in, I think, largely for reasons related to weapons of mass destruction.
But how do you put that to the side? President Bush describes it as a central facet of the strategy, and whether it is or not, it's clearly affecting the environment here.
Sure.
Jack Beatty's saying, pointing out, we spent $200 billion nearly already, and if we're there till 2012, maybe it'll be a trillion.
Right. No, and this is something that, in my mind, did not begin related to the war on terrorism, but today is there. And this is something that, whether you support the war or oppose it, you kind of have to accept today that how the United States handles Iraq is going to have major ramifications for the war on terrorism. In my mind, the danger of Iraq today with the withdrawal is that parts of Iraq would become a jihadist sanctuary in the way they were in Afghanistan in the past. And we're seeing small indications of that now, where jihadists are going to Iraq and they're flourishing. But if the United States were to withdraw, that presence might explode and the level of activity might grow dramatically. But the flip side of that is equally horrible, which is not only is this a miserable, costly effort, but the U.S. presence in Iraq is angering the Muslim world. So we're creating a well from which the jihadists can draw. And either way you go, you can argue you're damned on this.
Jessica Stern, let us put you in that hot seat in the Oval Office for a minute. You call the shots. You don't like what's happening with the war in Iraq. You've got a big critique here. How would you change it, the strategy, the approach?
Well, I've agreed with everything that Dan has said so far, and I share his concern about the difficulty of either approach. Unfortunately, the president made a very bad decision. We are left with two very bad choices. One, to leave Iraq as a failed state, perhaps collapsing into civil war, certainly leaving pockets where terrorists could operate. On the other hand, staying there, providing a source of legitimacy for Islamist rage around the globe. And it's a very, very difficult decision. Those are the things we have to weigh. I would argue for withdrawing, putting in place a mechanism to minimize the risk of the downside, including getting the UN involved, getting others involved, but drawing down our troops.
And if that meant risking a failed state, would you still favor withdrawal?
It does mean risking a failed state. There's no question.
You would take that risk?
I'm afraid I think that we have reached a point where I guess I just think it's going to happen whenever we leave, and I see the costs are so high to staying. So what I'm suggesting is that we're going to have to take actions to minimize those risks whenever we leave. And I think it's getting to be about time for us to take that option very, very seriously.
Rick is calling from Boston. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I think your guests mostly seem to misunderstand the nature of the problem that we're having.
Let's hear it. How do you see it?
And the source of the problem.
How do you see it?
Well, I want to back up a little bit to remind people that in 1996, before President Bush was the president,
mm-hmm.
before we were in Afghanistan, there was an attempt to blow up the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
93. From my perspective, the source of what the Islamists really want is what they've wanted since the end of World War I. They want to reestablish the Islamic Caliphate. They have wanted to establish it. There's been, and that's really the issue. Immediately after the September 11th, in the first fatwa that Osama bin Laden delivered, he spoke. Almost the first thing he said was that for the last 80 years, they've been humiliated.
So,
and that's back to the end of World War I.
Rick, let me ask you, they can want what they want, at least that core around bin Laden. The question is, do we have the best strategy for counteracting that, for minimizing it, for marginalizing it? What do you think?
They want to reestablish their caliphate. And that means we have to get out of large parts of the world. And it doesn't really matter where we are. They want what they want, and we're going to have to face them.
Rick, we've got it. Jessica Stern, this is your bailiwick. What do you say to this interpretation?
Well, I think that's part of their strategy. I think, as Mike Scheuer said, the Al-Qaeda movement partly has political objectives, very strong and clearly articulated political objectives. Where I differ from him is I think there's an organizational dynamic that takes hold. I think they also have utterly unrealistic objectives, such as establishing a caliphate, mystical objectives. They are influenced by dreams, etc. It's a very complicated picture. If we look only at their desire to establish a caliphate and ignore their political objectives, or vice versa, I think that we misconstrue the organization, the movement, and its goals, and how to fight it.
And it matters how many people are signing on to this agenda in any case. I mean, if it's just a few guys in the hills, it's one thing. If it's people streaming out of Iraq into Europe, into London, into the subways, that's another.
Exactly. And I think there's a lot more support for trying to force us out of Iraq than there is for establishing a caliphate.
Nino's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Nino. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for having me. A sad occasion for actually great conversation. I would like to approach this whole thing from a very different angle.
All right.
I would like to be kind of a little bit of a devil's advocate.
Let's hear it.
Let's start by premise that we, the United States and the Western world, are not a democracy anymore. We became a dictatorship.
Well, that's a big premise. Where are you going with that?
Dictators are a combination of big business, financial institutions, and alike.
Well, okay, even if we swallow that big chunk, where does that take us in the war on terror?
This is how it goes. They own our politicians. They write our laws. They dictate our foreign policy. They dictate how the world trade and world markets work. And with this, they already own our societies.
Are you saying this is how Al-Qaeda looks at the world?
Not necessarily Al-Qaeda, but
yep.
That's where they're recruiting tens of thousands of people. Because they've been invading societies through the rest of the world for decades. They didn't ask anyone, do they want stuff or values that they're selling, but they're selling it on a massive scale.
So here's the kind of great Satan view of the United States. Our time is short. Nino, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, I'm sorry we haven't gotten back to you quicker, but you hear the kind of flow of this conversation. I expect you're still sitting there thinking about that $200 billion or $1 trillion spent in Iraq and how it might have been spent otherwise. That's fairly fundamental as well.
It is fairly fundamental. You know, between the wars, the French built the Maginot Line. They essentially put billions into this, and then in June of 1940, the Germans pretty much came around it, And the Maginot Line shows that great nations can make fundamental strategic miscalculations, that they can fight the last war, or they can try to, redo the current reality to fit what they can do. In other words, to the guy with a hammer, everything is a nail. And to me, that's what we're doing in Iraq. We know how to fight wars. That's not a war. That's a sort of shooting gallery. We can't even police the 10 miles to the airport. The idea that somehow our military is doing something good there, actually working for us, suppressing this insurgency, just seems to me to require much, much more proof than what we've seen.
Jack, we saw elections there just a few months ago, and the hope was riding high for weeks that we might be on the way to a stable, democratic Iraq that would be a bastion of stability, not a hellhole in the Middle East.
And yet look what's happened since, the tempo of attacks, the attacks on the Muslim ambassadors and consuls. These people know what they're doing, and the uptick in U.S. casualties every week, more and more, heading now to 2,000 dead, 14,000 wounded.
Dan Byman, we've just got 20 seconds here. Do nations historically make course corrections in a strategy in the midst of something like we're in the midst of on terror? Do you see the U.S. getting this as right as it could possibly be at some point, at any point?
Nations certainly make course corrections. Usually it requires painful mistakes. And that's exactly the sort of thing that we may see in Europe now. Well, we saw this with Spain taking a different tact after the Madrid bombings to a degree, but it requires at times repeated blunderings, repeated levels of pain, and as history has shown, we don't always have that luxury. So,
and with that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Daniel Byman at Georgetown University, Jessica Stern, author of Terror in the Name of God. Jack, thanks for being with us. We close tonight with voices from the UK today, people who witnessed and survived today's bombings in London.
Roughly 1 minute down into the tunnel towards Russell Square, there was a loud bang. The train sort of seized up and ground to a halt. But then a whole load of smoke billowed through and was just tumbling through the carriage and just hit us all. So we all started covering our mouth.
People were screaming, fighting. And then the more and more smoke came in, people started saying the last prayers, as it were, last messages to loved ones. People then became more and more agitated, thinking they were going to die.
We was walking from King's Cross up past Euston, and I just heard a bang. I looked around, the whole top of the bus and the back of it just came off. There was debris everywhere, people just running. A lady that I was with, that I was asking directions from, someone fell on her.
People on the train were sort of talking together, how are we going to get out, what are we going to do? Everyone decided not to smash the glass and go out because we thought the smoke was coming from outside and we were afraid there might be live track. So we held tight, and after half an hour, the engineers came and opened the doors and lifted us out one by one and directed us back down the track towards King's Cross.
Now, to walk down the track, although the man I was talking to was walking wounded, cuts and scratches, a very grey face from the explosion.
I heard a very loud bang, the lights went out and the carriage filled with smoke, and people were thrown forward. I was in the front carriage and people were severely injured there, but I've heard, and I don't know if it's right, that people were even worse further back.
People were hysterical, severely injured, and from what I understand, in the middle of the train, some people may well have been dead regressively, you know, but I just thank God I'm alive.
Voices from London today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio. This